You're listening to the Triangle Radio Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the Holiday 2017-2018 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part B. Here's the continuation of FLOTUS Position by Sarah Ellison. What does Melania do with her days? In September, almost a year since the election, she gave her first public comments in her long-awaited anti-bullying campaign when she visited the United Nations and hosted a luncheon for the spouses of world leaders at the U.S. mission to the UN. By our own example, we must teach children to be good stewards of the world they will inherit, she read, haltingly, from the teleprompter. We must remember that they are watching and listening. As adults, we are not merely responsible, we are accountable. Melania, in a $3,000 neon pink Del Pozo dress, delivered her comments during the same trip to the UN in which her husband called Kim Jong-un Rocket Man and threatened to totally destroy North Korea. Compare Melania's schedule with the push-ups Michelle Obama did with Jimmy Fallon and her repeated appearances on The Ellen DeGeneres Show and many others, or with Laura Bush's launch of the first National Book Festival in 2001. Hillary Clinton, much to the detriment of her popularity ratings, threw herself into a contentious health care debate. Barbara Bush supported the Equal Rights Amendment, putting her at odds with the conservative wing of her husband's political party. Melania has always been a private person, according to friends. She was born Melania Neves in 1970 in a small town in Sevnica, Slovenia, when it was still part of Yugoslavia. Her parents, Amelia and Victor Neves, led a privileged life compared with their peers. Amelia, a stylish woman who grew up on a farm, had a career at a clothing factory, while her husband Victor, a member of the Slovenian Communist Party, sold cars for a state-owned automobile company. Melania's parents relocated to the United States to live in Trump Tower. They are close to Baron, their grandson, who speaks Slovenian as well as English. He has an accent? Larry King asked the Trumps in 2010, when Baron was just 4 years old. Melania's parents spend time in the area where Baron attends private school, according to a former West Wing aide. The idea is presumably to provide Baron with the kind of stability the Obamas sought for their daughters, by inviting Michelle Obama's mother, Marian Robinson, to live with them in the White House. The aide also told me that since Melania moved to D.C., her focus has been on Barron's school. I think it would be better for Trump if she were around more, the former aide said. But an East Wing aide told me that, aside from her son's school events, Melania does not spend much time away from the White House. She has not always been a political asset. Melania burst into the political news in 2016 when an anti-Trump super PAC featured a photo of her from the January 2000 British GQ. Lounging naked on fur aboard Trump's private plane, wearing only handcuffs and diamonds. Later in the campaign, the New York Post published nude photos of Melania from her modeling years on the newspaper's cover, with the headline, The Ogle Office. Jason Miller, the senior communications advisor for the campaign, called the photos a celebration of the human body as art. She seemed unprepared for some of the scrutiny leveled at her, as when she wore 4-inch stilettos on her way to visit storm-ravaged Texas in the wake of Hurricane Harvey, or when she dressed in a $51,500 Dolce & Gabbana flowered coat on a trip to Italy. On the Trump's visit to Israel in May, Sarah Netanyahu was overheard by a local broadcaster comforting Melania with these words, "You know, in Israel, all the people like us. The media hate us, but the people love us, like you." Still, on that same overseas trip, it was Melania who received the warmest reception from Pope Francis, whom Donald Trump has called disgraceful. Francis had only kind words for Melania. He asked her if she fed Trump potika, a Slovenian nut bread, possibly referring to Trump's widening girth. He was very friendly with her and not with the rest of the family, someone briefed on the trip to me. In a rare campaign speech for her husband in April 2016, Melania Trump took to a stage in Wisconsin. "It is wonderful to be here today with you and with my husband," she began. "I'm very proud of him. He's a hard worker. He's kind. He has a great heart. He's tough. He's smart. He's a great communicator. He's a great negotiator. He's telling the truth. He's a great leader. He's fair." According to Donald, Melania wrote that speech herself. She seems to have since elected to use a speechwriter for those occasions when she makes public comments of any kind, in person or in writing. In one recent instance, she tussled with her husband's first wife, Ivana Trump, who was promoting her book. In an appearance on ABC's Good Morning America, Ivana said that while she has a direct private number for the White House, she doesn't call her ex-husband because Melania is there, and I don't want to cause any kind of jealousy or something like that. She went on, "Because I'm basically first Trump wife, okay? I'm first lady, okay?" It was a fairly lighthearted comment. Melania elected to respond through her communications director, who issued the following statement. "Mrs. Trump has made the White House a home for Barron and the President. She loves living in Washington, D.C., and is honored by her role as First Lady of the United States. She plans to use her title and role to help children, not sell books." 4. What She Wants. Paolo Zampoi had just spent 2 hours in the East Wing when I spoke with him in early November. The U.N. ambassador to Dominica and former modeling agency proprietor was pleased to catch up with his old friends, Donald and Melania Trump, whom he had famously introduced nearly 20 years ago at a Fashion Week party he hosted at the Kit Kat Club in New York. The Trumps had invited him and his young son to the annual White House trick-or-treating event. Never mind that 2 former Trump campaign officials had been indicted that morning, and a third, a former campaign advisor, had pleaded guilty to lying to the FBI about the Trump campaign's ties to Russia. Just that morning, Trump had stayed upstairs, watching television news reports of the indictments and seething at the way he was being covered. But you wouldn't know it from watching Melania greet costumed children later that day on the South Lawn. "The media has been tough on her," Zampoli told me, "but he sensed a shift underway. People appreciate, and the poll numbers also show, that she's more appreciated than the president or the first daughter." A recent CNN poll found that Melania Trump is more popular than her husband, with 44% of respondents holding a favorable view of her versus her husband's 41% approval rating. Moreover, President Trump has a 57% unfavorability rating, whereas Melania's stands at only 35%. Ivanka Trump was flat at 41% favorable and 41% unfavorable. Jared Kushner ranked last. Only 20% of respondents had a favorable view, and 39% had an unfavorable one. For Melania, being more popular than her husband is an increasingly easy task. Zampoli's modeling agency provides a famous piece of Melania's backstory. It was this agency that found itself at the center of a lawsuit that Melania Trump filed against two outlets, the Daily Mail newspaper's parent company in the UK and a Maryland-based blogger, Webster Tarpley. In August 2016, Tarpley, 71, published a story on his website reporting on rumors that Melania Trump had once worked as a high-end escort. A Daily Mail story made the same allegation. Melania Trump hired Charles Harder, who had become famous for a Peter Thiel-backed lawsuit against Gawker Media on behalf of his client, Hulk Hogan. In September, she sued Tarpley and the Daily Mail for $150 million. The lawsuits eventually landed in separate jurisdictions. Her suit against the Daily Mail's parent company claimed that the articles hurt her chance to establish multi-million-dollar business relationships during the years in which she would be one of the most photographed women in the world. The suit, filed in the Commercial Division of New York State Supreme Court in Manhattan, said the article caused Melania's brand to lose significant value, as well as major business opportunities that were otherwise available to her. The suit said the article had hurt her unique, once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to launch a broad-based commercial brand. The Daily Mail's parent company agreed to pay a reported $2.9 million to Melania Trump, and it issued a statement as part of the settlement. "We accept that these allegations about Mrs. Trump are not true, and we retract and withdraw them," the statement read. "We apologize to Mrs. Trump for any distress that our publication caused her." A separate settlement was reached with Tarpley, which included a similar retraction. Zampoli declined to discuss the case, but he was happy to outline the chaste nature of Melania's arrival in New York. "She arrived, and she came to model," he told me. "She didn't come to party. Some girls come and are attracted to New York City, and they are trapped in the New York nightlife. Not Melania. She came for a reason, to model and to work. She was not going out." Zampoli knows this because back in the day, Melania was friends with his girlfriend, who was from Hungary. They were going to the gym a lot, and to swim, and to the movies. They were doing what girls do. Zampoli batted aside any intimations that Melania is not happy, reasoning that to be the most famous person in the world is not that bad. He went on, "I don't think you can come up with a conspiracy theory that she is not that happy. She is the First Lady of the United States. Come on." Still, he acknowledged that it had taken her some time to get used to the role. In what he characterized as personal speculation, he told me that in the beginning it was not pleasant, owing to the scrutiny of the campaign. Now, Zampoli concluded, she is warming to the role. She knows what she wants. But does she? Melania may well have wanted a very different life from the one she is currently leading. In that path not taken, she would be out of the harsh glare that her husband's campaign and presidency have cast upon her. She might even be living a sumptuous but quiet life with her son Baron in Manhattan, where he could still attend his old school. Instead, as things are, when she's not seeking solace with her parents, she is sitting above the nuclear football, perhaps wishing she could use it. From Amy Fine Collins comes this Vanity Fair spotlight, The Hottest Snow on Broadway. Photographed by Andrew Eccles. Kaisi Levy as Elsa, Patty Murin as Anna, and Jelani Aladdin as Kristoff, photographed in the Rocky Mountain town of Leadville, Colorado. For director Michael Grandage, the themes of Disney's Frozen are Shakespearean. The storyline, familiar to grade schoolers everywhere, resembles As You Like It, albeit with a talking snowman. Two girls are locked in a palace, Grandage explains, and they escape. If the Broadway adaptation of Frozen, opening in March, repeats the spectacular success of the 2013 animated film, audiences will likewise be forever escaping into the St. James Theater. To delight Frozen fanatics and attract new devotees, Grandage and his creative team have aimed simultaneously to remain true to the source material while introducing to the stage iteration more gravitas, he says. Layered into the fairy tale are darker motifs, derived from the liminal world of Norse mythology. The comedic rock trolls, for example, have morphed into shadowy hidden folk, inspired by the Huldra, a Scandinavian forest spirit. Even Sven the reindeer, now a lifelike puppet, has become poetic, Grandage says. According to the director, the powerful bond between sisters Elsa and Anna, played by a luminous Kaisi Levy and a winsome Patty Murin, respectively, explains why the tale resonates so deeply. And of course, there is that mighty showstopper, Let It Go, the musical climax of the 19-song, two-act extravaganza. It appeals to the underdog and to the outsider, says Grandage. People who need a voice have adopted it as their anthem.
Thank you.
The Devil and O.J. Simpson. After serving 9 years for armed robbery, O.J. Simpson is out on parole, living in borrowed luxury and swamped with selfie-seeking fans and business proposals. Yet he's also a fugitive from Fred Goldman, who's still determined to make Simpson pay, literally, for the 1994 killing of his son, Ron. Mark Seal chronicles this latest chapter in the increasingly surreal O.J. saga. Opening photograph by Andreas Branch. Free and easy? O.J. Simpson at the Grape Street Cafe, Wine Bar and Cellar in Summerlin, Western Las Vegas, in November. O.J. Simpson likes to relax at this bar, even though he's shackled to a strict drinking limit. That is one of the terms of his parole, not to drink to excess, defined as 0.08 or higher blood alcohol content level. Simpson monitors his blood with a personal breathalyzer day and night, since a parole officer could burst into either bar or bedroom to test him at any moment. He's also forbidden to touch weapons, imbibe marijuana and other controlled substances, or associate with felons. One slip-up, and he'll be sent straight back to Lovelock, the Northern Nevada prison from which he was released on October 1st, after serving nearly 9 years on 12 charges, including armed robbery, kidnapping, and assault with a deadly weapon. He always enjoys a single drink, a Ketel One martini, three olives, extra cold, says a waiter who serves him regularly at Grape Street Cafe, a restaurant and bar in downtown Summerlin, a planned community developed by the Howard Hughes Corporation in western Las Vegas. Summerlin is a pristine, perpetually sunny world, an incongruous home for this infamous criminal, or martyr, as his attorney calls him. When Simpson moved in, many residents of this mostly white, gated community on a golf course erupted with anger on the Neighborhood Watch website next door. O.J.'s in the neighborhood, one wrote, beware of him and the circus that follows. Lest we forget, he's a murderer, wrote another. Any reasonable person in this country would not want that man in their neighborhood, wrote a third. One person countered, so where would you like him to move? We've got former and present-day mob bosses living amongst us, known gang affiliates, drug lords, sex traffickers, yet you are overly concerned with O.J. Tonight we are eagerly waiting for O.J. to emerge from the 5,000-square-foot, $1.8 million home, with a Bentley in the garage and a swimming pool where he currently lives. The house and the car have been lent to him by James Barnett, a friend for 20 years, since Barnett hired O.J. to give a motivational speech at his company. Precisely at 6 p.m., O.J. arrives at the bar with two friends. Now 70, he is a massive presence, towering over the young woman at the hostess station. Seeing him makes it all come back, one of the tawdriest stories in the annals of American crime. O.J. Simpson, whose 1995 trial and acquittal on charges of murdering his ex-wife, Nicole Brown Simpson, and her friend, Ronald Goldman, made him America's first reality TV star. The court proceedings, obsessed over worldwide, were recently revisited in the FX series The People vs. O.J. Simpson, and in the E-SPAN documentary O.J. Made in America. 13 years later, he was convicted of armed robbery for bursting into a Las Vegas hotel room with guns and goons to rob two memorabilia dealers of O.J. Simpson mementos. Next photos, judgment call, post-prison phone shopping at Verizon with daughter Arnell. Wheel and deal, applying for his driver's license at the Nevada DMV. At Grape Street, however, he is hailed as a conquering hero. Sometimes it takes him 10 minutes to move from the hostess station to his table. So desperate are his fans for a handshake, a hug, or a selfie with the former Nevada Department of Corrections inmate number 1027820. I texted my boyfriend and was like, "Dude, O.J. Simpson is in the restaurant." And he was like, "No way. Go take a picture and get his autograph," says Desiree Touchette, 24, one of the many young women who approached Simpson for a selfie embrace. I was like, "Seriously?" And he was like, "Desi, I promise you, he's like one of the most famous people in the world." Tonight, as always, O.J. is all smiles, handshakes, and bear hugs. And he keeps smiling, even when the hostess tells him that his usual table, a high top for six that can accommodate his bulk, is occupied. No worries, he will be back. He waves to his friends at the bar and lumbers off in search of food and Monday night football. Next photo, trick-or-treat, greeting children on Halloween outside his house. Blood money. One man who will never forgive or forget sits seething in his home outside Phoenix. Pinned to his Hawaiian shirt, a real estate broker's badge bears his name, Fred Goldman. O.J. is a sociopathic, narcissistic piece of garbage, says Goldman, whose son, Ron, 25, was stabbed and slashed dozens of times, his jugular severed and his lung punctured before he died alongside Nicole. How do you avenge the murder of your son? For Goldman, with blood money, wherever the killer is hiding his assets, we'll find them and take them away, says Goldman. In 1997, a civil jury accomplished what the criminal trial had not, finding Simpson liable for the deaths of Ron and Nicole. O.J. was ordered to pay the families of the deceased $33.5 million in damages. Adamant that he was innocent, O.J. made it publicly known that every cent would be extremely difficult to collect. All I hear them talk about is money, 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 blood money. Simpson's attorney, Malcolm Laverne, says of the Goldmans, adding that his client is not earning a living to pay the Goldmans, that's for sure. O.J. told Fred Goldman to his face, "If I have to work to pay you, I'm not going to work." The only measure of justice that we are going to get is by taking things from him, says Goldman. To this end, he enlisted the fierce collection attorney David Cook. The web address for his company is squeezebloodfromturnip.com. He is voracious. He is almost as passionate about going after the killer as I am, says Goldman. So far, through court orders, they have seized the residuals from O.J.'s movies, including The Naked Gun and The Towering Inferno. They seized his golf clubs, bag, and gloves. They seized his gold Submariner Rolex, which turned out to be fake, and they scoured the earth through digital alerts and confidential informants for any attempts by O.J. to monetize his name. A helmet signed by O.J. is worth $350, says his longtime memorabilia dealer, Bruce Frumong. Jerseys are $200 to $300. Cook has heard that O.J.'s first post-prison interview could be worth $2 million, but that money, too, would be accompanied by a court-ordered seizure from Goldman. All of this means O.J. Simpson has had to become a fugitive from Fred Goldman. He cannot exist without attempting to monetize himself, says Cook. The moment O.J. tries to make a dime, bam, we're going to reach that stream of income, even if it's offshore. In 2000, O.J. began working with a company called Spider Boy International, owned by Norman Pardo, who became Simpson's de facto manager. For 7 years, Simpson worked as an entertainer, traveling with Pardo on a 35-city tour. Come see O.J. Simpson, dressed in everything from a football jersey to a pimping mink coat. Watch him introduce sexy headliners like Foxy Brown and Wyclef Jean. "Don't throw nothing at me, I'm coming out," O.J. would exclaim from the wings, and audiences loved it. Our society has changed. The bad guy becomes the good guy, says Pardo, and O.J. reveled in being the good bad guy, taking his pay each night, which ranged from $5,000 to $10,000 in cash. "You can't give O.J. Simpson a check because there is a judgment against him," says Pardo. "You can't do a contract with O.J. Simpson because any contract that has money in it belongs to the Goldmans. The only way to pay O.J. Simpson for anything is to bring a briefcase full of cash." O.J.'s biggest payday almost came in 2006 through a publishing deal with Regan Books, then a division of HarperCollins. The title was If I Did It, his ghost-written confession about how he would have killed Ron and Nicole if he had indeed killed them. The advance, estimated at $750,000, was funneled through a shell corporation. The book, however, backfired, becoming such an embarrassment that HarperCollins canceled it, pulping 400,000 copies and firing its editor, Judith Regan. The Goldmans were awarded the rights to the book by court order and released it as their own, changing the title to I Did It, Confessions of the Killer. The if from the original title hidden in small type. Fred Goldman wrote an introduction, and Dominic Dunn, who famously covered the O.J. murder trial for Vanity Fair, wrote the afterword, calling the book a crooked scheme to make money on his murders. I Did It was published on September 13, 2007. That day, Goldman and his daughter Kim appeared on the Oprah Winfrey Show. The same night, Simpson led the armed robbery at the Palace Station Hotel and Casino. "Do I think he did the robbery to beat out Fred Goldman?" asked Goldman's enforcer David Cook. "You bet." A new chapter was about to begin, and as one of O.J.'s accomplices would say, it was a typical O.J. move. Next photos, home stretch. The 5,000-square-foot house with Bentley on loan to O.J., and joy juice mingling with fans at the Grape Street Cafe. Thick as thieves. The day of the robbery, September 13, 2007, Simpson was in Las Vegas to be best man at the wedding of his friend Tom Scotto. He had also arranged to meet with Thomas Riccio, an ex-con and memorabilia dealer, with whom he had hatched a plan to recover personal effects that had once been in the trophy room of his Brentwood house and were now being offered for sale. Riccio told O.J. he had been contacted by Alfred Beardsley, an O.J. groupie, who wanted to sell the items. 1,000 in all, Beardsley said. These included the fabled tan suit that Simpson had worn in the Los Angeles courtroom on October 3, 1995, the day he was acquitted of the murders of Ron and Nicole. So his suit was emblematic of his invincibility to the justice system, a suit of armor, according to Cook. The items were stashed in a $39.95 a night room at the Palace Station, not far off the Strip. O.J. had enlisted a posse of 5 men to intimidate the sellers and help retrieve the material, which O.J. claimed rightfully belonged to him. At 7:38 p.m., O.J. walked into room 1203, along with the 5 hastily assembled accomplices, one of them brandishing a gun, and 2 of them looking like they were out of Miami Vice, slicked back hair, Versace glasses, suits. Charlie Ehrlich, one of the accomplices, later told E-SPAN. They were nowhere near the 1,000 items promised, but the trove included a commemorative football, a photo of O.J. with FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover, and 3 ties O.J. wore at his murder trial, but not the acquittal suit. In addition to Beardsley, there was another sports memorabilia dealer in the room, Bruce Fromong. The two were stunned when Simpson strode in a state of rage. Riccio had hidden a digital voice recorder to capture the proceedings. "Don't let nobody out this room," Simpson commands on the recording. Then addressing Fromong, "MF, you think you can steal my shit to sell it?" "A guy puts a gun in my face," Fromong tells me, recalling how one of Simpson's accomplices struck him on the shoulder and raised a gun like a punk, holding the gun sideways, gangster style, and saying, "I'll shoot your ass." "Pack up all the stuff," says Simpson. After 6 minutes, with the loot bagged in boxes and hotel pillowcases, they were gone. "I'm O.J. Simpson," he would later tell the Los Angeles Times. "How am I going to think that I'm going to rob somebody and get away with it? I thought what happens in Las Vegas stays in Las Vegas. You've got to understand, this ain't somebody going to steal somebody's drugs or something like that. This is somebody going to get his private belongings back. That's not robbery." Judge Jackie Glass didn't agree. At O.J.'s sentencing, she observed, "You went to the room, and you took guns, meaning you and the group. You used force. You took property, whether it was yours or somebody else's. And in this state, that amounts to robbery, with use of a deadly weapon. The jury convicted you, and now I'll sentence you." Next photo, behind bar, at his high top at Grape Street. Footloose. "I basically have spent a conflict-free life," O.J. told the Nevada Board of Parole at his successful hearing on July 20, 2017. His release was destined to become a spectacle. It was set for October 1st at High Desert State Prison, 40 miles outside Vegas. There were hundreds of calls inquiring about it on one prison representative's cell phone alone, with myriad requests for interviews, all denied. "The media onslaught was ratcheting up to a very dangerous situation," says Nevada Department of Corrections Rep. Brooke Keast, who coordinated Simpson's release. "I didn't know if they were journalists," she says. "It could be an assassin, or it could be a person that wanted to do harm." Some insist O.J. was lusting for attention after 9 years in media isolation. "Put a camera in front of him, and he could be two doors down, and he'll come running," says his friend Tom Scotto. He would bid goodbye to Lovelock, a cruise ship surrounded by barbed wire, says O.J.'s prison guard of 7 years, Jeffrey Felix, referring to the medium-security prison with ping-pong, bocce, good food, and social workers. Goodbye to the 15-by-8-foot cell he once shared with a serial rapist. Goodbye to his anger management classes. Prison officials decided to trick the press, which included all the major networks, whose people had created a sort of media village outside High Desert State Prison, where the state's inmates are typically released. Simpson, however, was kept at Lovelock, where he was released at 12:08 a.m. in a high-security maneuver Laverne compares to a SEAL Team 6 Osama bin Laden operation, in order to avoid the Lady Diana effect, people chasing him around on the highway. The ruse worked, leaving the prisoner undisturbed when he stepped out a free man. He looked right, left, and then skyward into the clear, crisp desert night. "I'm looking for drones," he said, searching for television network surveillance. But he found only stars. O.J. climbed into a light-colored SUV and was escorted by prison officials to Interstate 80. "Everybody was like, 'O.J. is going to Reno,'" says former prison guard Jeffrey Felix, who wrote a book, Guarding the Juice. "You have my blessing to jump first to the chapter dedicated to O.J.'s penis, chapter 11, he wrote in the introduction. "Let me tell you, dude," Felix says, "I hung out with O.J. for 7 years. He's going to Vegas, and he's staying in Vegas." First stop, McDonald's, where he reportedly devoured 2 combo meals. He had also dined there 23 years prior, with actor-turned-hostile witness Cato Kaelin on the night of the murders of Nicole and Ron. There was a $20,000 bounty on the first post-prison photograph of O.J., says Norman Pardo, who finds it curious, and may be carefully choreographed for profit, that a video camera caught O.J. at a gas station an hour out of Vegas, just before dawn. "Are y'all stalking me?" he asked from the back seat. It was after dawn when Simpson rolled through the gates of the country club community to Barnett's home in Las Vegas. Not only has Barnett said he's convinced of Simpson's innocence in the murders of Ron and Nicole, he also believes O.J. was victimized in the Vegas robbery. So Simpson can remain in Barnett's home, at least for now. He's got no mortgage, no rent, access to a Bentley, says Scotto. A welcoming party celebrated O.J.'s arrival. He slipped off his post-prison denim and stepped into new civilian clothes. He enjoyed little things, like struggling with the newfangled iPhone his daughter Arnell taught him how to use, and dinner with supporters, including F. Lee Bailey, O.J.'s defense attorney, from the double murder case. "I don't think he knows what his plans are," says Bailey. "He's been screwed twice by the American justice system, but I never saw a guy who could take a punch better." O.J. now has to learn to live on his estimated $25,000 a month NFL pension, which is exempt from seizure by creditors. How would he be regarded in the outside world? "He was unsure," says Laverne. "We had security plans in place. You've got people like the Goldmans going, treat him like a pariah, which required precautions. He had to be driven around and escorted. Finally, he put on his face paint and powder. O.J. won't leave the house without makeup," says Pardo, and stepped out to find that people didn't run from him. They ran toward him. "He has just been blown away," says Laverne, adding that there's only one comparison. "You know he and Donald Trump were friends, right?" he says, comparing the surprise appeal of O.J. to the unexpected victory of Donald Trump. Do not underestimate the broad base of support that Mr. Simpson has. Bubbling below O.J.'s smiling surface, former friends insist, is an angry O.J., unrepentant, determined to cash in. "He's a psychopath," says his bail bondsman Miguel Pereira, who formerly owned a company called You Ring, We Spring, which gained attention when Pereira processed the bond to get O.J. out of jail after the Vegas robbery. The bail bondsman began giving away pins inscribed O.J.'s Way Out, and is now marketing the movie rights about his time with Simpson. Adds ex-LAPD officer Ron Shipp, a former friend and confidant of O.J.'s, "O.J.'s about the dollar bill. When he beat the murder rap, he was advised by his attorney Johnny Cochran to not do an interview for a year, and he couldn't wait 1 month. I think O.J.'s going to try and make as much money as he can. I don't know how he's going to launder it, hide it." O.J. Simpson has changed, but not in a positive way, says Pardo, who spoke to him often while he was in prison. He was raised a Baptist, but when he went in, he started reading the Koran. He said, "For the first time in my life, I feel like a black man in the 1940s in an all-white justice system, and they lynched me." 4 days after his release from prison, O.J. was photographed signing memorabilia, the proceeds from which should go to Fred Goldman, says David Cook. "I had a guy offer me $2,000 to meet O.J. and have him sign a helmet," Bruce Fromong says. "Are you handling any of his memorabilia now?" I ask. "No comment," he says. Right now, he is out trying to make some new friends because he needs things, Pardo adds. "You're O.J.'s friend as long as he needs you. When he doesn't need you anymore, he'll say, 'I don't even know who this guy is,' which is what happened to me and many others." Offers are evidently rolling in. "Everyone is talking about reality shows," says Malcolm Laverne. We get flooded with calls with people saying, we've got a $50 million deal for Simpson, or we're an agency and we've got a business proposal for Simpson. He is ignoring them all. He's a senior citizen. He is enjoying his life. And he's just breathing, learning to exhale after being in jail for a decade. Pardo says he has a deal from an individual offering to pay off the entire multimillion-dollar judgment to the Goldmans and the Browns and put O.J. back to work. And Scotto says he's been marketing the first post-prison interview with O.J. for more than $1 million. When O.J. wants to talk, we'll make a deal to do it, says Scotto. On November 8th, Simpson was banned from the Cosmopolitan Hotel after being escorted out of its clique bar around midnight. He had reportedly become drunk and disruptive, according to TMZ, all of which his attorney hotly denies. The story was totally bogus, O.J. claimed. Can O.J. Simpson remain clean until he's off parole in 5 years? Mark Furman, the controversial LAPD detective first on the scene in the 1994 murder case, and never willing to give O.J. the benefit of the doubt, says it's going to be a long 5 years.
Thank you.
Now a Vanity Fair spotlight from Rebecca Keegan, Hollywood's New Classics, with photographs by Art Stryver. Greta Gerwig, photographed in Los Angeles, and with Jordan Peele. At the foot of a sweeping staircase in a stately Bel Air mansion, Greta Gerwig leaned in to adjust Jordan Peele's bow tie as a camera shutter snapped. Gerwig's sparkling gown and Peele's velvet dinner jacket were all in line with the era of classic cinema the photo shoot was meant to evoke. That she, a 34-year-old actress turned director from Sacramento, and he, a 38-year-old biracial actor turned director from the Upper West Side, would have been scarce in that age, as they still are today, wasn't lost on the pair. "This is the greatest party we never went to," Gerwig said between shots. In an industry where women directors and directors of color are still shockingly rare, Gerwig and Peele have broken through and made two of this year's best-reviewed films in Get Out. Peele hides uncomfortable truths about race inside the Trojan horse of a crowd-pleasing thriller. In Lady Bird, Gerwig tells the coming-of-age story of an awkward, theatrical Sacramento teenage girl. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service and broadcasting from its Raleigh, North Carolina studios. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.